Stephen.
Hello, Stephen. How are you? How are you enjoying the well, I can't say it's spring. It just feels like summer.
Okay, I did that Canadian thing yesterday. I switched directly from furnace to air conditioner.
Yeah, with no nothing intervening.
Nothing in between. You know, you'd like to think you got a couple of days in between where you can open the windows and all the rest. And we've had such a truncated spring that all the trees in my backyard are going absolutely nuts. It's like a tree orgy out there. And there is pollen on, you know, like an inch thick on everything. It's just, you know, it's this green dust. I have one of the back windows open and all of my electronics now are covered in green dust, which can't be good for them because the pollen blowing in from the window. So good thing I'm not allergic. Otherwise I would be coughing and sneezing like crazy.
And that would be an interesting podcast.
It's just everywhere.
Well, I think that at this point, the seasons in Canada should be fall, winter, fall again, summer.
Yes.
Because during spring, a lot of the temperatures varied between winter and fall, but no real spring.
No. And you know, it's too bad because spring is one of the nicest seasons and we just don't get one anymore.
We don't get it. We've gone directly from complaining about the cold to complaining about the heat.
Yeah. And it's like, I saw someone yesterday. Yeah, it confuses people, you know, the change of the weather, because people dress for the calendar, not for the weather. And somebody was biking down the street and he was wearing one of those puffy black ski jackets.
Oh.
And they're like, yeah, well, maybe when you got up this morning, it was, you know, there's a little bit of a nip in the air, but you know, it's now like 28 degrees, unless you're trying to lose weight. It's, you know, the challenge of keeping up with your clothing. I have a migration of winter clothes go downstairs and summer clothes come upstairs. And I haven't done that yet because I'm still not sure we're not going to get another snowfall. But
well, I haven't changed my winter tires yet, but that's mostly me being lazy.
Well, you're getting good traction.
It's time to change them. So we've got some interesting topics to talk about today.
Yeah, a lot going on.
Yeah, some of them are third rail topics, at least one of them. We'll try to handle it with as much objectivity and sensitivity as we can.
As we always do.
Yes. But I want to talk about what's going on in the Middle East between Israel and Hamas. I don't necessarily want to talk about the ins and outs of who's right, who's wrong. I want to talk about the fact that the dialogue is woefully uninformed, that I see people on Twitter throwing around terms which don't actually apply, but are really good buzzwords to get people emotional. It's a topic that where people's emotions rule. And so trying to have a logical conversation with them it fails. And as a result, there is this undercurrent of terms and things that are going around and beliefs that bother me. As someone who supports Israel, which does not mean I support everything they do, you know, the Israelis and the Israeli government aren't the same people. As someone who supports the right of Israel to exist and defend itself, I find these comments to be very difficult to read because they're not accurate. Can I run through a couple?
Yeah, absolutely. And you and I had a little chat beforehand. And you know, I've had Jewish partners in my law practice. I've had Jewish business partners. I had a Jewish girlfriend briefly. But at the same time, not being Jewish myself, not being someone who has any great interest in the Holy Land the way some evangelical Christians do, that part of the world. Is I'm aware of it, but I'm aware of it at the same level that I'm aware of, say, the Rohingyas in Myanmar. It's it is a very foreign part of the world to me. And it's, you know, it's an important part of world events because the United States has a historic close relationship with Israel. There are conflicts in the Middle East pretty much constantly. So, you know, you read about it in the news, but, you know, it doesn't really... And I think this happens for a lot of people, and this is why people resort to the buzzwords that you're going to educate us on. It really doesn't penetrate much deeper in our consciousness than that, and because we don't really have a dog in that fight.
Yeah, and I do. That being said, I support Israel's right to exist and its right to secure borders and to defend itself. I also believe in the right of the Palestinians to have their own state that they govern. And one thing that people don't seem to understand, that I see confusion all the time, people believe that there was a Palestinian state, and then Israel was created and took away half of the Palestinian state. The fact is, there was no Palestinian state. There's been no state of Palestine governed by Palestinians ever. And that's an important part of understanding the whole situation as it's unfolded, is that they've got this idea that Jews were just bussed in and displaced Palestinians. Jews have lived in that area. It's their ancestral home for centuries, like actual centuries. And the British Mandate of Palestine, which was controlled by the British, they, in 1948, proposed a partition plan which would take the land that exists, which was under British control, and the British would cede control, half of it to the Palestinians and half of it to the Israelis. The Palestinians wouldn't accept the partition plan. They thought that Israel was relatively weak and they were populous. And famously, they said, we're going to drive the Jews into the sea. So all the surrounding Arab nations attacked Israel on day one, expecting that it would be destroyed fairly quickly, as most of the world did, including the United States. Israel surprised everybody and won, and established itself its borders, and in the process, repelling the Arab forces, it started the entire cycle, because there was a number of times that Arab forces tried to destroy Israel and have been pledged to destroy Israel, as Hamas continues to be pledged to do. And Israel defended itself. And in one of those cases, they gained land, East Jerusalem, for example. When they were attacked by other countries, they defended themselves. They wound up getting land as a result of it. And people want them to give the land back as if they stole it, when in fact they got it when defending themselves. Now, I'm not saying whether it makes sense in a practical level for a peaceful resolution to return that land with certain security guarantees. But the idea that Jews were not there and that Jews were brought in and shoved the Palestinians out isn't accurate. And the idea that there was a Palestinian state isn't accurate. It's important to have those bedrocks as an understanding. They talk about the expulsion of Palestinians in 1948 during the War of Independence in Israel. Well, the truth is somewhere in between. The truth is that a lot of Palestinians chose to flee their homes because they didn't want to be caught up in the fighting. And they thought they would just return to their homes when Israel was quickly defeated. When Israel wasn't defeated, they were stuck. There was also the case of members of the Israeli Defense Force who forced Palestinians out of their homes because they were concerned that these were potential fifth columnists behind their lines and would act to sabotage and destroy what Israel was building. So there's a mix there. It's not one or the other. As people claim it's one or the other, both sides claiming that it's either one or it's the other. It's not. It's a mix of both. The idea that Israel is committing genocide isn't even supported by the UN legal definition of genocide. People see a couple hundred Palestinians killed and they assume that's genocide. There are 2 million Palestinians in the territories. A couple hundred is not genocide. There's a difference between collateral damage from military actions and people deliberately being targeted to be wiped out as a people. Now, logically, right now there are, 70 times more Palestinians in the West Bank and Gaza now than there were 70 years ago. If Israel has been trying to commit genocide, they've done a very poor job because the population has exploded. If Israel wanted to commit genocide, they could do it very easily. They wouldn't every few years engage in an action which kills a few hundred Palestinians. They would just go in there and wipe them out. The idea that Israel is taking some kind of long game to genocide, it doesn't make any sense on a practical, rational level. On the prevention and punishment of genocide, there's 5 points here. Two of them are too generic to really take seriously, and three don't apply. The first one is, in the present convention, genocide means any of the following acts committed with the intent to destroy, in whole or in part, a national racial or religious group. As such, a killing members of the group. Okay, well, that's just too vague. If a member of the group is opening fire on civilians and you kill them in the process of stopping them, that is not genocide. So that's too vague. Causing serious bodily or mental harm to members of the group. Sometimes certain policies affect their mental health. You can't. There needs to be something more specific about the intent of the policy. Deliberately inflicting on the group conditions of life calculated to bring about its physical destruction in whole or in part. That's not going on. People argue that it is. The fact that there are so many Palestinians alive and that they're prospering numbers-wise indicates that what's going on with Israel is a containment policy to try to keep terrorists out of Israel. They're not trying to destroy the Palestinians. Imposing measures intended to prevent births within the group, not happening. Forcibly transferring children of the group to another group, not happening. So it doesn't fit the legal definition of genocide. Does that mean that Israel its response isn't excessive? That the civilian death count isn't tragic and needs to be addressed? No, it doesn't mean that. It simply means that it's not genocide. Same with ethnic cleansing. I hate the term ethnic cleansing because it implies that the people who were removed needed to be cleansed, that removing them cleaned up a situation. And I find that whole term offensive.
Well, I think it's sort of the way people describe ethnic cleansing as sort of genocide light. It is trying to make places so hot that people want to leave and to erase any traces of those people from the places that they're encouraged to leave from. Ethnic cleansing is
very problematic term.
Yeah, I mean, it's not a term of art. It is, it became popular during as an expression, during the Serbian, Bosnian, Kosovo conflict. And I guess to a certain extent in Africa as well, in Rwanda. It tends to apply whenever there are religious differences between two identifiable groups, and one of them has the upper hand,
or different tribes mm-hmm. as well. It happens, but I don't like the term because, again, I feel like it implies that the group that was killed was dirty. This is just my read on it, but I just don't like the term. People ask, why are Palestinians forced to go through checkpoints to go into Israel? And why does Israel control the ports and the airports? Well, first, as far as people going through checkpoints, Hamas has dedicated itself. Its mandate is to destroy Israel by any means possible. So you don't just let people move freely when there's a group that is pledging your destruction. You have to be sure the people going in aren't those people. And so it's a terrible strain on the Palestinian people. But I don't know what people expect Israel to do. You just can't let people who've pledged to destroy you walk back and forth across your borders easily. As far as controlling the ports and the airports, weapons and things of that nature are often concealed in shipments from other countries. They've been intercepted, they found guns, they found bomb makings. And so Israel, again, is checking this stuff out to make sure that they're not letting in armaments or things that can be used against them. So is all of this a huge hardship on the Palestinian people? Absolutely. Is all of this really regrettable? Absolutely. Is it genocide or ethnic cleansing? No, it's not. And people focus on, people have been really focused on the number of children that have been killed. First of all, part of the problem is you can't rely on the death toll given to you by Hamas. It's been shown in the past that they inflate it. If somebody's in a hospital and dies of a heart attack during the conflict, they list that person as being dead from Israeli soldiers. They launch rockets which fail to take off and land in residential areas in the Gaza Strip and kill people. They include those people as having been killed by Israel. But I'm not arguing that there's been a very high civilian death count. That happens in conflicts. That's why we want to stay away from conflicts. Civilians always wind up getting killed. Even when you target only military targets, civilians wind up getting killed. This is just a fact of life. I mean, do people think that we won World War II without any civilians being killed? People, you know, it's hard to argue that World War II wasn't a just cause. And yet there were children who died as a result of Allied bombings and so on. Does that mean they should have stopped and let Hitler continue through Europe? No. This is unfortunate. This is a very sad part of war. This is why we don't want to have wars, because people are killed. And it's unrealistic to assume that they're not, but that doesn't mean that the civilians are targeted. If Israel, with all of its missiles and its might, wanted to target civilians, there'd be a lot more dead civilians. This is what's called collateral damage, which is a very cold way to describe the deaths of living people. But you have to separate that from the idea that they're being targeted and they want to be wiped out. Again, if Israel wanted to wipe out the Palestinians militarily, they could in a day, the way Jordan and Syria wiped out their Palestinian population, killed thousands in the course of a few months, and completely, nearly eradicated the entire population of Palestinians in those countries. They did it quickly. The world complained, and then the world moved on. Israel has not done that. And as a result of not doing what Jordan did, for example, it's got a situation that has become untenable a long time ago. It needs to be resolved. There's a problem with leadership on both sides. Benjamin Netanyahu is terrible for Israel. He's another Trump. He probably launched this offensive with the excess that he did to distract from the criminal
his domestic
trials.
Problems.
Yeah,
not the least of which being indicted for for corruption.
Corruption. Yeah, he is. I would consider him to be an evil man. In my view.
And also, you know, the world's attention is elsewhere right now. I mean, we're fighting COVID. We've seen this in a couple of places. We've seen it in China. We've seen it in a lot of not very nice jurisdictions where they take advantage of world disruption somewhere to go and get a free hand and, give some of their traditional enemies a black eye because they know that the rest of the world is preoccupied.
Yeah. I mean, you see that happening. And I think that Israel's response has been excessive. And I think that's because Netanyahu is trying to secure himself a government. They've tried four times to get rid of this guy. Nobody can form a coalition government there. That's why they've had so many elections. He is trying to scare people in Israel and make it like he's the one protecting them. He makes the situation worse and then says he's protecting them from the Palestinians, when he was the one who caused the problem in the first place. This is what people of his ilk do. They first create the panic and then say they'll protect you from it.
And I think it's important to point out, too, that there is a considerable opposition, not just to Netanyahu within Israel, but also to the way that the Palestinians are treated, both, not just in times of armed conflict like this, the general treatment of Palestinians within, as guest workers in Israel or, in the territories themselves.
Or as citizens.
Yeah. Yeah. This is the problem with sometimes the charge that, any criticism of Israel is anti-Semitism, which is absolutely untrue.
If that's true, there's a lot of Jewish anti-Semites in Israel.
Well, yeah, exactly. There are a lot of very vocal, prominent Jewish people, in Israel and in some of their biggest supporters in the United States, who are incredibly critical of, not just this particular incident, which started you know, Israel does have an expansionist policy into land that is Palestinian and has been for generations.
Yeah, and these settlements are illegal, and
but they're supported by the government, and they, you know, and they're settled by, you know, often they're settled by American Jewish immigrants who are incredibly militant. They're armed to the teeth. They are, you know, on the fanatic side of
a lot Judaism. A lot of them are super Orthodox.
Yep.
And which is very much apart from the Jewish mainstream in Israel. These are radicals.
Yeah, it's the way evangelical Christians are, you know, not, you know, except in the United States, but, you know, in general, you know, they're not part of the mainstream Christian tradition. And it's always the extremists who cause all the trouble. But, you know, the problem has been that they're armed, that they, you know, evict Palestinians who've lived there for generations, and they do it with the, you know, either the complicitness of, or the active participation of Israeli ground forces in chasing out Palestinians from what has been agreed by everybody to be their property. And they just do a might is right, and they just keep pushing out the borders into these settlements. Yeah. And Israel goes like, well, this is a buffer zone, so we're going to support it. At least Netanyahu and his right-wing ilk do. And eventually, you know, the idea is it'll be incorporated into Israel proper. So that, you know, that's what started this most recent one. It wasn't Hamas firing rockets into Israel. That was done because, frankly, they don't have a lot of other venues for protest because they are so marginalized and they have no levers of power. And it's the only time the world pays any attention, because otherwise, you know, the proxy war that goes on the border with the settlers goes unnoticed and unpunished.
Well, this is a problem with proportional representation governments. If you want an example of how it doesn't work, look at the Israeli Knesset.
Yeah, don't use the Israeli model. You know, anyone who's a big PR supporter in Canada, it's like this is just, you know, I'm not sure how many governments they've had since the founding of Israel, but it's been a lot.
Oh yeah, and the problem is that in that patchwork coalition system, usually it's Likud, which is the party of Netanyahu, relies on getting the support of ultra-nationalist, super-religious Jewish companies.
Crazy right-wing
countries.
Yeah.
And so they get a disproportionate amount of power versus their actual number. And in order to stay in power, the Israeli governments, who rely on these people to keep their coalitions alive, allow them to build these settlements which don't belong there. I mean, there was a time when Israel shut down settlements. It almost caused a civil war in the country, but they did. And in the future, settlements are going to have to be shut down. When there is actually a peace plan that can be accepted, and when the Palestinian side is united, so it's not, right now it's split in two different governments, that land is going to have to be returned. And Israel is setting itself up for huge domestic problems, because using the army to remove these ultra-nationalist, right-wing Orthodox Jews is going to be a huge problem domestically. So they're just setting themselves up down the road for huge problems, because there's no way Israel thinks they're going to keep all of these settlements. It's not going to happen. Israel has ended up, I mean, with Ehud Barak and Yasser Arafat working with Bill Clinton, they gave the Palestinians, or offered them, somewhere between 85 and 95% of what their demands were, including they were going to give them East Jerusalem. Yasser Arafat said no. And I think that's largely because Yasser Arafat knew that if there was peace, he would suddenly be marginalized as a leader. You know, military leaders don't necessarily make a good transition to civilian governments. But Israel has shown itself willing to make concessions. This present government doesn't. This present government wants to flex its muscles and wave its penis around and beat up on the Palestinians. And the soldiers are doing what they're ordered to do, which is not a fair answer for anything.
Yeah, just following orders hasn't worked in a couple of situations.
It's not right. I do believe it's been documented that Hamas does store weapons and build weapons and put bases in residential areas, in schools, in hospitals, near schools, in the building that the media was in. There's been proof offered that they were there in the basement. And they do it because they know that even if their depot is taken out by Israel, they win the PR war because they say Israel's attacking hospitals, Israel's attacking schools. Israel drops leaflets and says, we're going to do this, get out of there. I can't think of any other military that tells people where they're going to bomb, because it opens up their planes for counterattacks, because the people will be ready. But they drop things, they say, get out of there. But I'm not sure what Israel is supposed to do, leave these bases and these weapons manufacturing places active? Why is there no appropriation against the Palestinians for putting things in civilian areas like that? I mean, that is a war crime as much as attacking civilian areas is.
Well, and that's the problem, because at the moment, there's actually a good article on AP about, are Israel and Hamas committing war crimes in Gaza? And, the answer is both sides probably are, with the standard definition of war crimes. And one of them is civilian casualties. And while, every military operation has an obligation to minimize civilian casualties, unfortunately, with the war in Afghanistan or in the United States, the United States has been one of the worst offenders of this. They would drop smart bombs on weddings, famously, and claim that they were after a Taliban leader, and it turns out he wasn't there. It wasn't the intelligence was bad. The problem in Gaza right now is you can't trust either side. Because they both lie. Hamas lies, absolutely, about whether it's casualty numbers or that something was there were no it was just a civilian target and that the Israelis took out. But the Israelis also are not the most reliable when it comes to saying, we had intelligence that somebody was there, that, that 12-story building that housed the Gaza offices of the Associated Press and the BBC and Al Jazeera and a law firm and a lab for blood testing. That was a big Hamas, leadership office. I would expect that AP would notice if they were smuggling missiles in and out of their office building. But so I can't believe Israel is my problem, because they've been known to lie, and their proportionality, they're clearly targeting infrastructure, which is really just designed not to cripple Hamas in one sense, but it's to deny civilians clean water and power and hospitals and transport and all those things that makes life possible. And the thing about Hamas too is, it's also the government of Gaza. I mean, duly elected people, and not everybody who is Hamas is a militant, because it is there's a militant wing, there's armed combatants, but they're also people who deliver services in Gaza as part of the government, the elected government. One of the problems right now is there was going to be an election in Gaza. And, there's some talk that Hamas might have lost the election. That this is their own diversion from that. They picked a fight because they had their own political agenda. But a lot of members of Hamas are people who just run the post office there. They are not, Hamas at one level absolutely is a problem. But at the other level, it actually just runs Gaza for ordinary civilians. So targeting, saying someone is Hamas, you go, oh, that's terrible. It's like, well, yeah, but he's not an armed combatant, and he's not, maybe he says death Israel, when he checks in for work, but that's not what he's doing all day. He's trying to keep power running or water running or the schools running or other things. There's a lot of members of Hamas there because it's a big organization that helps run the civilian government.
Yeah, I think that fair targets our military leaders, strategists, soldiers, weapons makers. Now, fair targets doesn't mean get to them regardless of the collateral damage that you do. There has to be some humanity attached to it. There has to be some recognition that the civilian casualties will be just too much here.
Yeah, and that's been the problem, I think, you know, the West looks at, because Israel has one of the biggest militaries in the region. It spends more on its military than, well, I just saw that, you know, Biden just signed another $750 million arms deal with Israel. They spend a disproportionate amount of their GDP on military because they're surrounded by enemies, and they've got to do that. But when it comes to a fight between rock throwing people and, you know, these missiles, you know, these are short range missiles. They're not accurate. I mean, if they hit you, yeah, you'll be dead. But, you know, they fired how many missiles and they've killed 10 people. And the proportionality, and this is something, I don't know if you saw John Oliver on the weekend, he did a piece about proportionality in Gaza. And I think he hit the nail on the head, which is you've got this Goliath of a military force, which has some of the best technology in the world when it comes to killing people. And, you know, you're not supposed to make mistakes with those kinds of things when you've got civilians packed into a small area. And they're killing on a basis of 20-1 Palestinians. And that's the same as it's been in every conflict going back. The death toll on the Palestinian side, including women and children, has been disproportionately horrifically large compared to the handful of Israelis who get hit by a stray rocket.
Well, I mean, that has a lot to do with how cheek to jowl Palestinians are in Gaza, for example.
Oh, yeah. And that gives you the density. Not to pinpoint bombing and, you know, guided missiles and all that kind of stuff, or just saying, you know what, we can't bomb that because there's a hospital on top of it. And even if, you know, we need to take a couple of rockets, we can't be bombing hospitals because that's just wrong.
Yes, it is wrong to bomb hospitals. It's also wrong to put bases in the. This is where the problem exists. Nobody's right here.
Yeah, exactly.
It's one of those things, like, do you allow this organization that's pledged your destruction to continue to be able to build and use arms and strategize and so on because they've used people as human shields? Do you expose your population to greater risk because of that? Or do you evacuate the thing and destroy it? Because Israel can't send in, like, sending in ground troops to take those people out in the basement of a hospital? Not happening. That would be, ground troops would be horrendous.
Well, actually, Netanyahu said in a press conference yesterday that he's thinking about it. I mean, I'm sure he's just rattling sabers.
I think he's just talking.
But he says that he hasn't ruled out taking over Gaza Strip.
You know what? Israelis don't want it.
There's
a reason they withdrew. This takes a disproportionate amount of attention and money from Israel to manage all of this. That's why poll after poll for a long time, I don't know what the current poll is, but Israelis want this to end. Palestinians, you can't be sure how many want it to end because you can't do a free poll in Gaza. If you're caught or saying that you would like this to end and make peace, you're a collaborator and you could be killed, because that is what Hamas does to its own people within there. It has an iron fist. So we don't know how many Palestinians would like this to end, would like this to be resolved. But my guess is that a majority of them would like this to end.
And I'm sure.
Majority of Israelis would like this to end. I mean, and the thing is, you can't just impose a solution. What there needs to be is confidence building measures on both sides. Before you can negotiate with Hamas, they have to abandon their stated desire to destroy you. I mean, that's sort of basic.
I thought that they did. I thought they did in 2012. I mean, as part of their charter, they took it out. I'm pretty sure that Hamas said that. I can probably look it up. Actually, and do, 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 do. and. Here we go. May 2017, Hamas unveiled its new charter to moderate its image. Charter no longer calls for Israel's destruction, but still calls for liberation of Palestine and confirms the acceptance of the 1967 borders as the basis for establishing a Palestinian state, as well as not being an offshoot of the Muslim Brotherhood, which is, you know, kind of beside the point now. But what you say and what you do are two different things. I'm sure there are hardline Hamas people who still want the destruction of the Palestinian state. But as a matter of policy, Hamas no longer has that written in their constitution.
I stand corrected. Their actions say something
different. That was pretty recent to me, and that's only 4 years ago.
Yeah, and it, but you know, 4 years ago is still a long time. As far as it's a question of has the behavior changed? When they want to establish a Palestinian state, that could also mean all of Israel. You know, it could be Palestinian groups like leadership are famous for saying one thing in English to the rest of the world and a different thing in Arabic. And people never seem to call them out on it. Now, in this case, if Hamas is really willing, first of all, the 1967 borders are not defensible as they currently stand. There has to be some security established because Israel can't defend itself with those borders. It's just too hard to do it on an ongoing basis. So there has to be some land swaps that go on. Israel's going to have to give some of its land within the country to Palestinians, and Palestinians will swap some land with Israel so there can be a contiguous Palestinian state and the contiguous Israeli state. Hamas came about because they thought the PLO was too soft. And I imagine if Hamas was to make any kind of peace deal, there'd be a splinter group from there who felt Hamas was too soft. The problem is that people are inculcated there with, their websites still have links to the Protocols of the Elders of Zion, and their school books are notorious for teaching very racist, very anti-Semitic things. And you know what, this is the only education these Palestinians have. If they're being taught stuff that's wrong, how are they supposed to know that? It's not like there's a really free press there that can provide it. Palestinians have been used as pawns by the Arab nations since 1948. Because you know what? They could have been settled elsewhere. A lot of them settled in Jordan until there was problems there and Jordan smacked them down. But they could have been settled somewhere else. But the other states don't want them. If you look at the treatment of Palestinians and other Arab states like Lebanon and so on, they have, in some cases, they have less rights than Palestinians living in Israel. Palestinians are not well treated in the Arab world. And they're seen as a battering ram. They're a human battering ram to try to destroy Israel or force Israel into concessions. And these poor people are being used as pawns. And it's not their fault. The fact that they're so rabidly anti-Israel, anti-Semitic, they have been taught nothing but that in their schools. And you know, when you're taught something in a school, you tend to believe it, especially when you're not presented with another view or other perspective or other facts. I'm not excusing anti-Semitism, but I'm saying, where are they supposed to learn otherwise? And the only way they can learn otherwise is by interaction with Israelis and Jews. There's a lot of Palestinians who get along just fine with Israeli Jews. There's Palestinians in the Israeli parliament. If you look genealogically, Israelis and Palestinians are the same people. There is the addition of the Eastern European Jews after the Holocaust, and Israel was established so that Israel would have Jews would have a place to go when they were being persecuted, because throughout history, Jews have been persecuted, thrown out of their countries, back and forth, and they didn't have a place to go. And the final step was they didn't have anywhere to go after when Hitler was in power, because countries kept turning them away to get killed. So of course there's going to be immigration to Israel of Jews from Europe and the United States. The United States, they're not being persecuted, but they go there because they want to be in touch with their ancestry. But there's no reason that Palestinians and Israelis can't get along. The fact is, they live in the same part of the world. They live in the same neighborhood. They probably could have the same concerns, the same same things in common, more so than they would Arabs in than Palestinians would have with Arabs in the Emirates or Jews in Brazil, you know, because location and geography is really important as far as a commonality. There's, if only there could be a leadership on both sides that was not intransigent, that was willing. I wish they could get another Ehud Barak who was willing to give up so much for peace. Mm-hmm. I wish that Israel could get another prime minister like that. I'd like to think that the Palestinians at this point in time would take such an offer. But you know, these things inflame, and if I'm a Palestinian, and I know that Israel is responsible for bombing houses and so on, I'm not going to like Israel. And if I'm an Israeli and they remember buses being blown up, I mean, I worked with an 8-year-old girl on a TV commercial a few years back, and she went to Israel on a vacation, and she was killed by a bomb at the beach. These things can't be forgotten either, and they stick in the Israeli memory. But in order to go forward, you have to do more than remember. You got to project forward. You got to realize, okay, look, forget about who was here first, who wasn't. Let's look at what we have on the ground today. What can we do with what's here today? Let's forget the historical arguments and deal with today. What can we do? What can we do to coexist today? And put aside religious claims on the land, because every war, as you know, in history, every war ever fought has been for resources, no matter how you dress it up. And usually that resource is land. So how can this be set up? And how can the Palestinians learn to trust dealing with Israelis? And I mean, some of them have with the Palestinian Authority and so on. But how can Israelis learn to trust that the Palestinians aren't harboring weapons or bombs? And the way to do that is both sides need to take something of a leap of faith, which is a lot to say when you're talking about millions of people that you're responsible for. But sometimes that's what's necessary, is a bit of a leap of faith and recognizing that there's a lot more commonality than there is difference.
Yeah, and you know, the problem is, you know, a lot of it is you know, there are historic grievances and people fighting over the same land, and you know, who was here first and who has the claim to it, and you'll never sort most of that out. But if it's a political solution that's required, the problem is going to be that Netanyahu is not the guy to do it. Because you know, he's a hardline right winger who, you know, his history, I was just scrolling through his biography and includes such gems like him authorizing a Mossad operation in 1997 to assassinate the Hamas leader, Khaled Mashal in Jordan, just 3 years after the two countries had signed a peace treaty. Is this the kind of guy who's going to be generous and broker, give up anything and broker a peace with people he's bombed and tried to assassinate? I mean, it requires a complete change in leadership. And he's been prime minister now, what, four times, I think?
He's been there for years.
Yeah.
He rose to prominence during the Gulf War because he was an Israeli spokesman that spoke English because he grew up in the United States.
He grew up in Philadelphia. Yeah.
Yeah. And so he was very good and photogenic to the world, and it made Israel feel less foreign because here was this English speaking guy. And that cemented his permanent station in Israeli politics. But if you follow him, he's been getting crazier and crazier as it goes on. And that's why I'm sure these corruption charges are true, because when you've been in power for that long, I'm sorry, everything tends to rot.
Well, and I seem to remember it's not the first time he was charged with corruption. I think it was his first, either when he was Minister of Finance or his first term as Prime Minister, he was charged with corruption back then too, back in here, I'm just doing a quick little scroll here. And in 1997, police recommended that Netanyahu be indicted on corruption charges for influence peddling, which is the same thing that he's up for again this time. So he is, and he managed to work the system basically by appointing attorney general who would look the other way.
Yeah, and doesn't that sound familiar?
Yeah, and it didn't, and it didn't go anywhere. But again, you know, what hope is there for peace when, like you say, the leaders of Hamas are prepared to sacrifice their own people, and Israel is prepared to sacrifice as many people in Palestine as is necessary in order to prop up and distract from his right wing government that relies on even farther right wing parties for the support.
Yeah, and I just want to also make the point that there's a false binary going around online that if you support Israel's right to exist and right to defend itself, you support those principles, that then you are all for dead Palestinian kids. And that's a false binary, because I support Israel's right to exist and defend itself, but not at all costs. Like there are ways to do it that limit casualties, and there's more responsible ways to go about prosecuting, like retaliating for activities. So I am not in lockstep with the Israeli government and the things that they've been doing. Just because I believe Israel has a right to be there and a right to defend itself doesn't mean that I have no feeling whatsoever for the Palestinians, that I have no feeling for the children who have been killed. I think that it's, I have a real problem with the way Hamas brings the bodies out to be photographed. I think that's really disrespectful to the dead and using them as pawns. Israel doesn't do that because there's certain Jewish laws with regards to how a body is treated. Mm-hmm. So you don't ever see the same thing on the Israeli side, unless somebody gets there before the police and picks up the body parts from the bombs. But the idea that if you are a supporter of Israel's right to exist and defend itself, that you are then callous about the death of Palestinian civilians and children, that is just not true. It is a completely false binary. And I wish people would stop making that the case, like, oh, you support child murder. No one supports child murder, for crying out loud. I don't like any civilians being killed of any background, period. And I don't care how old they are. I don't like any civilians being killed. I think it's an unfortunate product of war, and one that we're never going to fix completely. I think every one of those deaths is tragic.
Yeah, and you know, and the problem, of course, with the Palestinians is, you know, they have recognition as a country from 130, 140 odd nations of the United Nations, but they really don't have the same sort of platform that Israel has. So I say, when they are showing the effects of bombing that has killed civilians, then the only way that they're going to get attention, like the rocket attacks, is that because they really don't have an awful lot of other, you know, ways to make their case and be heard on the world stage, whereas Israel has the ear of governments all over the world and political power and military power and all that other kind of stuff. Doesn't make it right, but I certainly understand why the Palestinians showcase the tragic civilian casualties, because they're tragic and it gets attention that they don't otherwise get. But it's like you say, it's again the proportionality of things. And the problem with Israel is that it has the capacity to do precision stuff, whether it is, you know, whether the raid on Entebbe showed you that they have all kinds of abilities. I mean, the Mossad is one of the and the Israeli Defense Fund force has the has specialists who are world renowned for surgical strikes. This messy bombing of Gaza is exactly that. And it's really hard for the rest of the world to see it as anything other than deliberate, because they know that Israel could do this a lot cleaner and more surgically than they do. But instead, they're making a point.
I don't know how surgically, like the thing is, Mossad operates on the ground. Their ground forces, they sneak in places, they sneak out places. They don't tend to use bombers or airplanes and things like that. I think that there's still a limit to how intelligent weaponry really is. There's also failures of human intelligence. I mean, the U.S. is famous for failures of human intelligence. Look at 9/11. Could have been prevented, but a failure of human intelligence. I think that saying that Israel can have complete precision, I think Israel touts itself as being able to have that. And I think the weapons makers tout that they can do that. I don't think anything is that pinpoint yet. Machines make mistakes. Computerized things make errors. And also, who is operating them? Humans. And that's always the weak link when dealing with these things. It's just a terrible situation. The idea that people are driving through London saying kill death to the Jews, rape their daughters, that's very disturbing. Now, should these people be taken as any kind of mass sentiment? I don't think so. I think there's always going to be loudmouth radicals who will say things and do stupid things. Doesn't make the danger from them less. But I don't think you can put on the entire Arab population of London that they're supportive of these people. My experience has always been in dealing with people of the Muslim faith when talking about the Middle East is a much more gray area understanding of what goes on there and a recognition of they have radicals which ruin things and Israel has radicals that ruin things. Israel needs to rein its radicals in more. It needs to, and so, I mean, so does Hamas, but unfortunately a huge wing of Hamas are basically what you could call radicals. There needs to be, again, some kind of deceleration in the conflict, and there needs to be confidence building moves. But you're not going to get it, as you said, with the present leadership on either side. And so what moves the leadership? In Israel, they've tried how many times now in the last year to get rid of Netanyahu? And he's still hanging on. Mm-hmm. It's possible that the next time they have an election, he could lose. I suspect that I don't know if this war will make him more popular or less popular. Typically, wars make people fall into line. Look at George W. Bush. Mm-hmm. I mean, the man was a joke before 9/11. And then everybody fell into line behind their commander in chief and elected him a second time. Whereas I think he wouldn't have been otherwise.
Your base.
Yeah, it's. I would like to think this doesn't help Netanyahu, but I don't know. I'm not in Israel. I don't know the sentiment there. I would like to think that Hamas leadership starts to care, you know, more about its people than its zeal, and is willing to say, okay, look, because peace is made between enemies, not between friends. So you're going to have to sit down. Both sides are going to have to sit down with their enemies to make peace. And there are disincentives on both sides. There's geographic support from other places. Iran is supporting Hamas. Israel has the benefit of the United States. And it's interesting that the Arab countries that recently normalized or relaxed their relationship with Israel haven't been vocal during all of this. I think this to me shows that the Arab nations have been using the Palestinians as pawns for a long time. And now that they're playing a different game, they've abandoned them.
Yeah. They're a thorn in the side of Israel, and you know and it's a cheap one to keep what does Russia like to do? You know, they like to destabilize you by promoting discord on your borders or with your enemies, and try to keep you occupied. And you know, the Palestinians are a perfect foil for that. I mean, they're being clearly being used by all kinds of people, regardless of any of their historic claims. And you know, a lot of countries like to see that because you know it gives them a cheap way of causing trouble for Israel, and it doesn't cost them anything because they really don't have any real commitment to the Palestinian people, which is really sad for this Palestinian people, because it's, you know, they don't have any other game that they can play.
No, they're stuck. I have sympathy for the Palestinian people because they've been used, now in a lot of ways abandoned by other Arab countries, because the Arab countries see more profit in a alliance with Israel against Iran than they care about the Palestinians. And so these people are, they're left in the wind. We're not going to solve it today.
No, I thought Trump had solved it, because didn't he broker this great Middle East peace deal, and it was going to be peace in our time, and he was going to get the Nobel Prize for it?
I mean, they did broker the deals with some Arab nations. Can't take that away from them. But but their idea for Middle East peace between Israel and the Palestinians was absurd. It was so heavily weighted towards Israel that no Palestinian leader is going to agree to that.
No.
A deal has to serve both sides' interests.
Yeah, and the Palestinian people, to the extent that they're a unified force, wouldn't put up with a leader who gave away as much as that deal purported to do.
No, they'd be dead.
Yeah.
So I think it's been a good conversation about this. You and I. In absent of yelling and screaming, which is really what you see even on cable news, they bring people in from opposite sides, and it's like two tigers in a cage going at each other. That doesn't solve anything. I think we both wish that this present campaign would come to an end, and it would sober up some leadership to recognize that this is not the way forward.
No, no matter how much benefit there is to the small political cadre of both sides in continuing the conflict, basically, I always believe that people always want the same thing. They want to be left in peace. They want to raise their children. They want to be healthy and happy, and be able to look forward to a better tomorrow. And unfortunately, especially on the Palestinian side, they don't have that to look forward to. And and Israel has its own security concerns as well. So, but I think at core, most of them want the same thing you and I want, which is, for our kids to grow up in peace and to have a better future. And that's not going to happen as long as it's in the best interests of the people who are running the show to keep people at their throats.
Yeah. Well said. Do you want to go on and talk about the U.S. Supreme Court?
Oh, well, briefly here, we've been talking for a long time, but it just keeps the abortion issue in the United States. It's amazing how it just keeps coming back.
It's scary. And, it's very scary to me.
Well, especially with The Handmaid's Tale in its fourth season now. It's there's a point where reality and that is going to cross, and it's just going to turn into a documentary. Because especially in the southern states, the Republican-led state governments keep bringing in restrictive rules about abortion, and sometimes they do it through the back door. They're doing it by getting rid of the clinics that there was one famous one a few years back where they said, well, any medical facility doing a medical procedure, which includes abortion, has to have hallways a certain width, which made no sense at all. Because if you're a small clinic, then you don't need this great big gangway to be moving gurneys back and forth on an emergency basis, because it's done basically in a dentist's office. But they brought in those kinds of regulations in order specifically to close down abortion clinics, or the ones that we're seeing now coming out of Mississippi and Texas, where they're limiting the term that where a woman has the right to an abortion. They keep making it shorter and shorter. And now they even have it so short now. Texas, I think, now is at 15 weeks.
15 weeks.
Where most people don't even know they're pregnant at that point. People are going to have to, get an abortion like the week after they have sex, just in case, because they're not going to know. Assuming that there's any even facilities available, which, is a big assumption in the United States. People have to travel great distances in order to find a clinic. Unfortunately, there's, especially in Maritime Canada, that is, even though abortion is unregulated from a criminal standpoint in Canada and has been for more than 30 years, there are still issues of access in Canada too. But in the United States, it's even bigger problem. And these things have all been shut down previously by the U.S. Supreme Court. We got a different Supreme Court composition now, and people are taking their chances that the Supreme Court's going to ignore its own precedent in Roe v. Wade, and they're going to have another look at it and say, yeah, you know what? States' rights. I think a state should be allowed to bring in this kind of legislation, because that's nothing to do with the federal government. If the will of the people is this, represented by the state in its ultimate wisdom, then who are we as the Supreme Court to step in on that? And that's the real danger in the United States right now, that they're going to keep seeing women's right to choose rolled back in state after state, because once one of them does it, you know what the Supreme Court has said about it, then all the rest of the states are going to say, we know where the line is now, we're going to go right up to it and maybe even a little past it.
It's, when I was forced to read The Handmaid's Tale back in high school.
Oh, lucky you. I read Surfacing. I think I would have rather read The Handmaid's Tale.
I thought, this is ridiculous. It is so far-fetched.
It would never happen.
It would never happen. And here we are, the U.S., half of the U.S. is tamping down and becoming more publicly religious. I mean, this is American Christianity, which is distinct from Christianity.
Yeah, it's its own version of it that Jesus would be completely unfamiliar with.
Yeah, it's a funhouse mirror version of Christianity that perverts everything Christianity stands for. But Americans like to wave their Bibles and delude themselves into thinking whatever they want to do somehow was benighted by God. They're becoming more like, they're moving backwards rapidly socially, and it's sitting here on this side of the border. It's almost like I can't believe it, because it just seems so, how can people be this backward in 2021? And yet they are.
Yeah. And, and not just backward, but, determined to go backwards, because Roe v. Wade said that the state may not prohibit a woman, any woman, from making the ultimate decision to terminate her pregnancy before viability. So this is the thing they keep going back to. So the one that's in front of the Supreme Court now, it's agreed to even consider it. Normally they would say, we're not going to consider it. We've already decided that Roe v. Wade is already there. And there's another one, Pennsylvania versus Casey, 1992, which upheld Roe and Wade. Normally the Supreme Court would say, we've already done this, we're not even going to listen to this case, we're going to deny leave to even hear it. But the fact that they said, you know what, we will hear it, like, give us your best shot, maybe we'll change our mind. And of course this was part of the Trump and Mitch McConnell program of packing the judiciary at all levels, especially the Supreme Court, by putting pro-life justices on the court. And Trump has said that was his goal at the time. So, and Dobbs, the Mississippi case, Dobbs and Jackson Women's Health Organization, about the Mississippi ban on abortion after 15 weeks, except in medical emergency or case of severe fetal abnormality. Texas has gone one better and said, we don't even care about fetal abnormality. You're going to have that kid. So they're really rolling back the clock a long, long way.
Yeah, it's it I just keep being spooked by what the national temperature in the United States. They're our biggest trading partner. We used to have a lot in common with them culturally and socially, less and less so now. The direction they're going, the rhetoric that they spew, their one side's lack of regard or complete disregard or disdain for truth and facts, it's nightmarish to watch this unfold.
Yeah, and it's particularly for Canadians because, you know, I've talked about this before, our justice system, you know, from everything from the way that justices are appointed to, you know, our real commitment to a lack of politics on the bench, and divorcing, you know, judges, not just in the appointment process. There used to be political appointments to judges, but, you know, sort of a magical thing happened when someone was made a judge is they lost all of their politics. And you were really more, you know, your religion was the law and respect for the law. It wasn't to push an agenda in Canada. Whereas in the United States, it's completely different. I mean, for us to say on a Supreme Court case, to predict who's going to vote which way on a moral issue is really, really tough because, I mean, you can look at how they've decided in previous cases to give you a hint, but it's always based on the law. It isn't just sort of, you know, some Supreme Court justices, some of the less bright Republican appointees say, you know, I feel it should be like this. And that doesn't happen in Canada. We don't care about your feelings. What does the law say? What does the precedent say? What do the authorities say? And, how do you apply, you know, in our case, the charter to the set of facts and balance everybody's rights? Americans can go through, you know, they say, okay, so, Alito, Gorsuch, Thomas, and Kavanaugh voted to uphold a Louisiana law, a case called Juvenile Medical Service in Russo in 2020. The Supreme Court struck it down. It was Louisiana law. It was one of these ones I was talking about where that required abortion providers to have admitting privileges at a hospital near the clinic where they perform abortions to be able to provide them. And it was just basically to shut down. It was a mechanism specifically designed to shut down clinics because they couldn't get hospital privileges. And so, but you know that those four judges, Alito, Gorsuch, Thomas, and Kavanaugh, voted to uphold it. Ruth Bader Ginsburg was alive at the time, and she, it was 5-4. Well, now it isn't 5-4 anymore because there have been, you know, that fifth seat has been filled, and Americans can tell how a judge is going to vote before they even hear the case. And that's the part that's shocking to Canadians.
With good reason.
Yeah.
I guess we'll just keep an eye on it and watch the nightmare unfold.
Yeah, from our catbird seat safely above the parallel and I say we have our own smaller vociferous group particularly within the Conservative Party that wants to bring in these sort of phony baloney limits on abortion, that haven't existed for a long, long time as sort of a wedge in order to get back at that issue to satisfy a small constituency, but very low vocal constituency within the Conservative Party. It hasn't had a lot of traction, but, you know, the problem has been our Conservative Party hasn't had the guts to stand up to them and say, you know what, we're not doing that. Because, you know, that's settled. You know, the Liberal Party, for all of its many warts and failings, said we will not endorse any candidate running for federal office who is not pro-choice. That is just, you know, one of their core values. The Conservative Party is, well, it's about free choice and, you know, we're a big tent and, you know, lots of views and all the rest. And you couldn't get Scheer, you couldn't get O'Toole to take a firm position themselves about either, you know, both of them were, you know, shaped very much by their own personal religions as well. But, they don't want to honk off their caucus, especially some of the evangelicals in there who owe their nominations to anti-abortion groups.
You know, I'll take the bad weather several months of the year. Yes. Just to live in a country that isn't a madhouse.
It's a small price to pay.
It's, you know what, snow tires and
they may be on there for a while longer.
Scarfs and hats and parkas, small price to pay for living in a society where we're not all suspicious of each other, where we're not all only in it for ourselves, where we give an elevated position to science and reason. I'll take it. You can have your U.S. South and your warm weather in California and your warm weather all year round. Take it. You couldn't get me to move there if you pushed me.
I do like Chili's restaurants, though. They have great appetizers. But aside from that.
But there's got to be some in Canada, no?
Oh, there used to be one in Mississauga, and I went out there once. I said, oh, this place is so great. And I took a friend there, and it was the worst lunch I've ever had. I think it's gone now. It's nothing like the American chain, which was, you know, big drinks and tons of cholesterol and cheese on everything and all, everything that will kill you. But it was so good. No, we don't have that in Canada, but still, I wouldn't trade it. I might go down and visit it sometime, but I will not trade it.
Yeah, I'm at the point now where I don't even know that I'd go down to visit.
I'm thinking long and hard about it myself.
Yeah, and I used to be very much an admirer of the United States, but you can't admire them now.
Yeah, it's getting, you know, between the guns and the craziness, it's just getting a little too Wild Westy for me.
Yeah, I'll stay here. Yep. Okay.
There's lots to do here.
Plenty to do. As soon as everything opens up again, there'll be plenty to do. And there's you and I talking every week.
Well, you know, something for people to look forward to.
Or grit their teeth. I don't care what it is, as long as they listen.
It's all good.
It's all good. We have a Facebook page, Stephen and Stephen, if you want to put some comments there. Stephen Lawton's can be found very actively on Twitter. It's at Stephen Lawton's. It's S-T-E-P-H-E-N. L-A-U-T-E-N-S. So feel free to express yourself, but do so in a reasonable manner, please.
Yes. Just in case right. My mom's reading it. Yeah.
Yeah, you never know. Hello, Mrs. Lawton. Okay. It's time for us to say goodnight. Thank you, Stephen.
Hey, always a pleasure.
And thank you for listening to Stephen and Stephen.